Hearty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Welcome to the sunny side of sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
The sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports.
The sunny side of sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports. Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
We're now less than 4 months away to the Rio Olympics in Brazil. Remember, VOA Olympic fans, the opening ceremony for the multi-sports extravaganza will be August 5th at the Maracanã Stadium in Rio de Janeiro. This evening, we shine the sunny side of sports spotlight on Meb Kiflezgi, who will be competing in his fourth Olympics for the United States. Meb will celebrate his 41st birthday next month, and he'll be the oldest member of the U.S. Olympic marathon team in Rio. Reporter Elizabeth Lee met Meb at one of his training sessions in San Diego, California, and she tells us how a refugee from Eritrea became an Olympic medal winner.
More than four times around the globe, that's the distance Meb Kiflezgi has run. And he's still running. He's competed in the Olympics three times, won a silver medal in 2004, and hopes to win another medal as the oldest ever U.S. Olympic marathon runner at this year's Rio Summer Games. He said it all started in middle school.
I ran a 520 mile, and that got me the A, got the T-shirt, and a lot of recognition, and that's how kind of got me out of my shyness, I guess.
But gaining such recognition seemed remote when he was growing up in war-torn Eritrea.
They didn't have opportunities to go to school. There was a lot of soldiers everywhere, and landmines were scattered around the country. So it was horrific to seem to be for a kid to grow up to. But unfortunately, that was the card that I was dealt with. But, you know, my parents better made a decision to escape.
Yet in the U.S., there were new challenges to overcome.
The language is different. So you can't, you know, you can't just say what you want to express. Sometimes you can't even say anything just because you don't know the words. So you kind of feel like kind of mute.
Bob Larson is Kiflezgi's coach of more than 20 years. He says he offered Kiflezgi a full scholarship to the University of California, Los Angeles, in part because he saw a toughness in him.
He's an exceptional person, and a big part of this, I think, is growing up in tough circumstances and being in a large family, doing some of those things routinely that would upset other people. He can travel anywhere. He can sleep anywhere. You know, he's just, the whole family is tough.
Larson says Kiflezgi can handle pressure in extreme situations, enabling him to win many marathons.
He's won New York. He's won Boston. Nobody's done that in an Olympic medal like he has.
Kiflezgi won the Boston Marathon the year after terrorists bombed the event in 2013. Kiflezgi says crossing the finish line at the Boston Marathon meant more to him than winning an Olympic medal.
I could feel that was a plateau of my career, and I was meant to be on this earth to be a runner to help others influence in a positive way.
He became a testament to America's resilience in the wake of the bombings by becoming the first American in 31 years to win the Boston Marathon. At the Summer Olympics in Rio, Kiflezgi will have a shot at becoming the oldest American to win a medal in any running event. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, San Diego.
Thanks, Elizabeth. 3 days ago, Meb Kiflezgi ran the Cherry Blossom 10-mile race here in Washington. Meb did not run to win, but instead he ran the race as a special training session. He acted as a pacer for a 6-minute-per-mile running group, and I'd say Meb kept the pace pretty good. His official finishing time was 60 minutes and 41 seconds. Meb described it as a wonderful experience, saying, and I quote, "To be able to run with the people, they appreciate it a lot more. I would love to keep coming back." As reporter Elizabeth Lee mentioned, Meb Keflezighi went to college at the University of California at Los Angeles, better known as UCLA. UCLA is also the alma mater of Chaka Sali, the Voice of America's popular Straight Talk Africa host. Chaka loves to puff out his chest with pride whenever there's talk of UCLA's men's basketball pedigree. The Bruins of UCLA have won a record 11 national titles. And in U.S. women's college basketball, the Huskies of Connecticut have now equaled that mark. Led by Brianna Stewart, the Lady Huskies routed Syracuse Tuesday night 82-51 in the national women's final in Indianapolis, Indiana. Connecticut finished the season with a perfect 38-0 record, and they join UCLA as the only U.S. college basketball programs, men's or women's, to win four titles in a row. Stewart tallied 24 points, 10 rebounds, and 6 assists in the final. During her 4 seasons for UConn, Brianna has won 4 national titles and is the only player to be named most outstanding 4 times in the Final Four. Very, very impressive indeed. Meanwhile, all 11 of Connecticut's national titles have come under head coach Gino Auriemma, who surpassed the late great UCLA coach John Wooden for career titles. Wooden won 10 national titles as UCLA's coach, and UCLA's 11th trophy came in 1995 under head coach Jim Herrick. If you tuned into Tuesday's Sunny Side of Sports, you heard me report how Villanova University won its second national title in thrilling fashion, beating North Carolina 77-74 on a buzzer-beating 3-point shot by Chris Jenkins.
They're playing back.
Hey, mates, remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right, give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively Sunny Man on the Sunny Side of Sports, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brillafm.net. I tell you this. It's always as thrill, yes, as thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I received a nice Facebook message from Henry Amara, who writes, "Wow, thanks, Sonny Young. I always listen to the Sunny Side of Sports." And Henry adds, "I listen in Uganda." Thanks for the Facebook message, Henry Amara. Well, I've been chatting with Dan Friedel of the Voice of America's Learning English Department about the new Major League Baseball season. During his recent trip to Havana, President Obama attended an exhibition game between the Cuban national baseball team and the Major League's Tampa Bay Rays Club. I asked Dan, do you see the president's Havana trip making it easier for Cuban players to get into Major League Baseball?
Some of the most famous Cuban players of recent years, like one player from the Los Angeles Dodgers, Yasiel Puig, have come out and talked about how they made it to the United States to get into the major leagues in the first place. Puig was the subject of a big story in the last couple of years about how he had to go through an interesting process where he paid smugglers to get him out of Cuba, and he stopped in Central America before he came to the United States. Other players have stories about going on rafts between Cuba and the southern part of the U.S. state of Florida. It's a short distance in the ocean, but it's very dangerous. The opening of exchange and trade between the United States and Cuba is certainly going to make this process safer. So that's a good thing. Major League Baseball has yet to talk with the U.S. government in a serious way about how to make that employer-employee relationship a little bit more formal. President Obama has talked about how do you open up relationship between Cuba and the United States and allow things like hotels to open up in Cuba, American-owned hotels to employ Cuban workers, and make sure that the Cuban workers are treated fairly and that they're paid a reasonable salary. So all of these things still have to get worked out. But the most important thing is that this dangerous process of leaving a hotel in the middle of the night when the Cuban baseball team is playing an international tournament, or risking your life to go across open ocean in a not safe vessel, all of that is going to change. So we may not see an influx of more Cuban players making an impact in the major leagues, because some of the players in recent years have talked about how baseball is still a difficult game. It's not like the people that are playing baseball in Cuba are playing a different game at a different level. Major League Baseball is still really difficult. Some of the best American prospects never make it to the major leagues. But it's going to be safer overall, and I think that's really important for these players because they're not going to be risking their lives to try to play a game.
Dan, during a recent appearance on the Sunny Side of Sports, Andrew Palcheski, the VOA's social media reporter, talked about major league teams having iPads in their dugouts this season. How is technology changing the way we evaluate players in the major leagues?
Like I said before, baseball has been a game that's played in the United States for over 100 years. And good baseball players are always going to be good baseball players. These famous people that played in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, players like Babe Ruth and Ted Williams and Henry Aaron and Joe DiMaggio and Pete Rose and on, those players were great players, and there's no debating that. But there is technology now that allows baseball management to really quantify in an objective way what makes a good baseball player. So if you want to talk about how fast does a fast baseball player run, instead of just having to extrapolate it based on a coach using a stopwatch and timing the runner from the time he leaves home plate and when he gets to second base, there are these systems now that are in place in all 30 major league stadiums which can precisely measure this. So I looked this up, and I found out that Usain Bolt, who is everybody's favorite Olympic sprinter,
right,
he is able to reach a top speed of about 27 miles per hour. Some of the Major League Baseball players who are seen as really fast runners can go about 20 or 21 miles per hour. And this is when they're changing directions, because the baseball diamond is 90 feet one direction, 90 feet another direction. You have to go from home plate to first base to second base to third base and back to home again. We've known that for a long time that really good pitchers can throw about 100 miles an hour. A strong major league pitcher who can have a good career might throw 95 miles an hour. That would be kind of the top of that velocity. But now we know how fast can the players on defense throw the ball. So my question, let's see if you can guess. What does a baseball player who's an outfielder, for example, throwing the ball to home plate, what speed do you think they throw the ball?
I'll take a guess, Dan. Somebody like Harper, maybe he can throw the ball 80 miles per hour to home plate.
So that's pretty close. That's a good guess. But some of the best outfielders who have the strongest arms last year were recorded as throwing the ball around 100 miles an hour. Of course, that's with running up and receiving the ball and having their momentum going toward home plate. My other question for you would be, how hard do you think the hardest hit ball was in Major League Baseball last year?
In terms of speed? Wow. Let me go up in velocity a little bit. I'll say 200 miles per hour.
200 is pretty optimistic. I'd like to see how how far a 200-mile-an-hour hit would travel. Giancarlo Stanton, who's this big, strong power hitter for the Miami Marlins, had the three hardest hit balls last year, and one of them went 120 miles an hour.
Wow, okay.
A couple of them went 119 miles per hour.
Okay, that's almost like a tennis serve from a top tennis player then.
So we're able to see these numbers, and the executives who are in charge of drafting players and recruiting free agent players and coordinating what kind of a team the organization wants to be. Do we want to be a team that has a lot of fast runners? Do we want to be a team that has a lot of hard hitters? They can take all of this data, they can interpret it, and then they can apply it to the makeup of their organization. So now all of these teams have these tools, and it's allowing these analysts to move to the next level. And we can see a good defensive player. How good is that player? And then we can compare it to other players in the game and kind of rank players in a different way than we did before. In the old days, we thought, oh, 50 home runs, that's a great hitter. And that's true. That's still true. But there are other smaller, more nuanced ways to grade a baseball player. And all of these tools are coming together to provide a clearer picture of what makes a good player.
Dan Friedel of the Voice of America's Learning English Department talking with me about technology in baseball and the new Major League season. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Sonny, thanks for having me. And I have a Major League Baseball preview up at VOAnews.com's Learning English page. So if you're interested in learning more about this upcoming baseball season, I encourage all of our listeners to check it out.
And what's that address again, Dan?
It's learningenglish.voanews.com.
Thanks, Dan. Reporter Mark Ouma joins us now with some football news from Algeria and Switzerland.
In Switzerland, FIFA President Gianni Infantino has strenuously denied involvement in corrupt deals while at the European football governing body UEFA. Infantino's problems emerge from the recent disclosures in Panama called the Panama Papers. According to the Panama Papers, contracts co-signed by Infantino as UEFA Director of Legal Services between 2003 and 2006 link UEFA to a company called Cross-Trading, which is hugely implicated in the unfolding FIFA corruption scandal that has brought down the disgraced former FIFA president, Sepp Blatter. Cross-Trading is a subsidiary of Full Play owned by Hugo Jinkies, who is implicated in a South American ring of corruption in football. The United States Department of Justice prosecutors uncovered evidence that Jinkies is implicated in massive bribing of football executives. Jinkies and his son Mariano are under house arrest in Argentina. UEFA also signed deals with Traffic Sports Europe, a Brazilian company indicted by the United States Justice Department. In his defense, Infantino says he has never had any personal contact with the companies Cross-Trading or Traffic Sports Europe. Frenchman Christian Gourcuff has resigned as coach of the Algerian Desert Fox. Under Gourcuff, Algeria won three matches and drew one to top their group in the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. The Algerian Federation says assistant coach Nabil Neghiz takes charge of the team on an interim basis.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of the VOA's Daybreak Africa radio show. Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Sporty greetings, Andrew.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Good to be with you.
Andrew, what's trending in the sports world on this Wednesday?
So yesterday we talked about the NCAA men's basketball final, where it was a close game, that last second buzzer beater. And last night we had the women's final, and total opposite. The UConn women blew out Syracuse 82-51. They won by 31 points, and in doing so claimed their fourth consecutive national championship. I think they're something like 76-game winning streak, something like
incredible.
That, maybe 77 now.
Incredible.
It's a dynasty. It really is. So a lot of talk about that on social media, just the dominance of these UConn women.
Quick sunny side of sports shout-out, Andrew, for one of those UConn women, Brianna Stewart, the consensus National Player of the Year. How many students go to college or university for 4 years, and every year you win the national title?
And the first player, by the way, man or woman, to do so, win it for all 4 years that they've been in college. So
incredible.
You know, a lot of attention on Brianna Stewart. Her Twitter account, she had the four trophy emojis that she tweeted out. She's very excited about their four consecutive championships, certainly her four awards that she's won. Interesting that she is from North Syracuse, New York. So she grew up just down the road from Syracuse University, and that's the team that they played in the final and beat. So I don't know if she grew up rooting for Syracuse, or at least she was closer to Syracuse than Connecticut. But
now, Andrew, some basketball fans feel that the Connecticut women's dominance of the game is not good for women's basketball, that it doesn't allow for development. What are your thoughts?
It's that argument that's been made, but other people say that it's putting so much attention on women's basketball because people are watching UConn and watching this dominance. They're tuning in. Something I saw very briefly, that the ratings this year were lower for the TV broadcast. So maybe that is the case, that less people are interested, saying, oh, UConn's going to win, why bother watching it? But there was one tweet that I saw where a gentleman said that the UConn women winning is evidence of how tough it is to succeed when the pressure is on you. And they pointed out the Golden State Warriors last night lost to the Minnesota Timberwolves in overtime. The Minnesota Timberwolves have a record of 26-52. So they said that when you have the eyes of the world on you and all this attention on you, it's the pressure point. You either rise or you start to crack. And they're saying the fact that the UConn women rose to the occasion and won this just shows how dominant they are and how tough it is to do this.
And one other quick shout out, Andrew, for UConn's head coach, Gino Auriemma. He now has 11 championship rings. How do you fit those on your hands now?
He's got to double up. We might start giving them away or something, or he could put one in the showcase and then wear the rest of them. I don't know how you could do anything if you're wearing the 10 rings. It's going to be hard. It's certainly hard to tweet or do any social media activity, for sure, other than maybe a picture.
Andrew, I encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. And on the Twitter front, Andrew, I understand there's some interesting developments.
Big news for Twitter. They have won the rights to show National Football League Thursday night games. So the football season here in the U.S. doesn't kick up until September. So we've got, what is it, about 7 months or so, 6 months. But Twitter has won these rights, so they're going to show these games in some capacity on Twitter. Now, I say some capacity because a lot of people on social media are questioning how they're going to do this. I've read something that says you won't have to actually log into Twitter to watch these. They're going to put them somewhere on their page where you can see them even if you don't have a Twitter account. So I'm curious to see how this develops, how they're going to showcase these games, if it's going to be pinned to the top of your Twitter feed, if it's going to be one of these Twitter moments that they have. But certainly kind of an affront to Facebook. Facebook was pushing very hard to get these rights, and they didn't get them. Twitter did. So we'll see if it's a boon for Twitter and how many people flock there on Thursday nights. Also, whether or not you can watch them internationally. Twitter, of course, is an international social media network, but a lot of these games are only shown in the U.S., and they're blocked overseas. So maybe they'll be blocked overseas still, or maybe it'll be open up to the whole world.
Andrew Palcheski, the Voice of America's social media reporter. Thanks for joining us again, Andrew.
Of course. Thank you.
And that wraps up the April 6th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. VOA engineer Nick Ivanoff. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is crucial that the overwhelming good being done by peacekeepers and other international forces in the Central African Republic be reinforced by full and complete accountability for the betrayal of trust by some among their ranks who have sexually exploited and abused civilians. One report from the international advocacy group AIDS Free World cites additional findings by UN officials in the Central African Republic, or CAR, of allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse by UN and non-UN personnel there between 2013 and 2015. 108 women and girls, the majority of them minors, claim to have been sexually abused, reportedly by UN and African Union peacekeepers and French forces whose presence in the CAR was meant to ensure civilian protection. It is the latest in a series of such accusations against international peacekeeping forces in the country. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Ra'ad Al Hussein, called the new accusations sickening, and the UN Stabilization Mission in the CAR, MINUSCA, has launched a full investigation into the alleged conduct by UN and French troops, as well as local armed groups. We are taking these allegations, some of which are particularly odious, extremely seriously. It is vital, he said, that victims are protected and the abusers be punished. There has to be accountability and there has to be credible deterrence. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Samantha Power, who was in the Central African Republic to attend the inauguration of the country's new president, Faustin Archange Touadéra, had the opportunity to meet with some of the families of victims of abuse in the town of Bambari. It was gut-wrenching to hear them speak about how the peacekeepers they had looked to as protectors became perpetrators, she said. Ambassador Power noted that the people of the Central African Republic witnessed the potential for peacekeepers to do tremendous good and also for them to inflict tremendous harm. This plague of sexual abuse must stop, she insisted. Would-be perpetrators have to know that they cannot get away with such abuses. UN member states must thoroughly and impartially investigate and, where appropriate, prosecute individuals alleged to have committed sexual exploitation and abuse, said Ambassador Power. The UN Security Council and all member states must see to it that we live up to the standards we have set. We are seeing the devastating consequences when we do not. The stakes of addressing this problem for the victims, for nations like the Central African Republic, and for the UN and its member states could not be higher.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the role of development partners in promoting democracy and good governance in Africa. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there is a youth culture that is being progressed by the youth globally.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent
to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.